Hey everyone, we're looking to add a new member to our engineering team. Ideally, we're looking for a senior level mechanical design engineer in the Phoenix area who has experience designing custom automated machines, equipment, and test fixtures. Also, having working experience with controls and system integration is a plus. If you'd like to apply or suggest someone, please email us at info@testfixturedesign.com.
The Being an Engineer podcast is a repository for industry knowledge and a tool through which engineers learn about and connect with relevant companies, technologies, people, resources, and opportunities. Enjoy the show.
And remember, physics starts with the letters PH, which is also the starting of the word philosophy. If you don't understand the philosophy, you have no hope of applying the math. And often, the philosophy is all you need.
Hello, and welcome to the Being an Engineer show. Today we have an incredible guest. His name is Alexander Slocum. He's a professor of mechanical engineering at MIT and is one of the authorities in the realm of mechanical design. He has written two books on machine design, Precision Machine Design, and Fundamentals of Design. There's a free download at pregatory.mit.edu, and that's going to be in the show notes. He has published more than 150 papers, has 130-plus issued patents. Alex regularly works with companies on the development of new products and has been significantly involved with the invention and development of 11 products that have been awarded R&D Top 100 awards. Alex is a fellow of the ASME and the recipient of the Society of Manufacturing Engineers Frederick W. Taylor Research Medal, ASME Leonardo da Vinci Award, the ASME Machine Design Award, and the Association of Manufacturing Technology Charlie Carter Award. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering and was the Assistant Director for Advanced Manufacturing in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House in 2013. He loves woodworking, snowboarding, hunting, and endurance sports like marathons and triathlons. Alex, welcome to the show.
Howdy, howdy.
That was such an intro. All right, so let's dive right in. Saying that you've been very successful is an understatement. When we first talked on the phone, you asked me to refer you as Alex. So I have a couple of contacts at MIT, where you're a professor, and they told me that you have a reputation of having no ego. You're all about results and helping people. How did you manage to be so successful and have no ego?
Well, I spent my early years on the beach in California, and you know, on the beach, I think everybody is just who you are, right? You're all there having a good time. And then raised, you know, by my mom and dad, who were, my mother was a mathematician, dad was a physicist. And they both taught me that we stand on the shoulders of giants, who also stood on the shoulders of giants going way back. So whenever you think you're so beautiful and wonderful and marvelous and the best thing, that's okay to help you keep going when things are tough. But you got to remember that without all those other people before you and the team around you, you're just another happy life form out there on the beach. So chill out, dude.
Yeah, there's somebody in our team. His name is Michael, and he always says that phrase, we stand on the shoulders of giants. Yeah. He's a very humble person, and he also has like no ego. So, all right. So next question is it possible to raise a family while you have a very powerful career? Could you share some of the tips on work-life balance, please?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to know when to leave work alone and when to be with the family. But those are words that everyone says. So here's how you actually do it. You take a deep breath and you recognize that when you bang your head against the wall to solve a problem, you dent the wall and flatten your head. And you may start to make inroads on the problem, but there's a time to take a deep breath, walk away from it, and change your operating environment. Change the brain chemistry. Get the endorphins flowing. Get good things happening. And that problem that exists in your mind, right, it will come back. And your brain will be working on it, working. And then, bing, solution. Now, the other thing, there's two other real practical things. When I first got married, well, my wife was a graduate student, I was a junior professor, we had stuff to do, and somehow she got pregnant. We're still trying to figure out how that happened. No way you have time when you're working so hard, right? But then, boop, kid appears. So there'll be times like, you know, she has to take a test or she was a teaching assistant. So I'm watching the kid. And I figured, okay, kid, stay there and watch me work while I focus. Now the kid is going, gah, gah. Flat. And then I realized, let me try this. I think maybe my mother suggested this. Get down on the floor, put the kid in the floor, kind of like putting Baby Yoda on the floor, you know?
Okay.
I got, you know, your big sheets of this stuff they used to use in the last millennium. It's called paper. I think somebody used to pronounce it paper. And these things called crayons. Right. And they're really neat. The kid can eat them. You get multicolored poo. They're not toxic. There's no caps to leave off to dry out either. They always work and they're bright colors. So, you know, paper and crayons for the older set here. And, so I'd start sketching stuff and the kid was so happy because I was on the floor with the kid playing. Now the kid didn't know I was drawing a transmission or working out the block diagram for the control logic for a machine. All the kid cared about that I was with the kid, bright colors, and I would make monsters and, you know, floral scenes and stuff because gears make really pretty flowers. So I found this weird thing that sitting on the floor with my kid, drawing, thinking about work, but watching the kid playing, you know, it's fun. Your brain has got endorphins flowing. It's a different kind of chemistry that's going on in there. And I was thought different and a much more creative or different creative. And I got a lot done. It's like, dude. So I pass this on to everyone I can to, you can do that. Now, the other thing you do is you get a spinner and not one of these fancy ones where you're connected to the internet and blah, blah, blah. But you just get a basic spinner for your bike and you get kind of a music stand type thing. So you're spinning, getting exercise while you're reading through, because a lot of stuff you got to do for work only takes 3, maybe 4 brain cells. And so you can spin at a reasonable rate, get your heart rate reasonable while you're reading through reports and all that stuff and get exercise. So I would get up real early while everyone was still. And then I'd go downstairs spinning and get a lot of my reading done for the day. And then you get off the spinner, everyone's up, and then you have breakfast, nice day, get everyone off to that, and then you go work.
I really like the answer about the crayons, getting on the floor. That's very clever. So one day when I become a dad, I think I'm going to try that too. I wanted to add, go ahead.
So keep practicing on working to be a dad. It's a lot of fun. An important part of building a family is practice, right?
Exactly.
Keeping the endorphins flowing.
So I also wanted to add that you have something similar with Aaron Munker, who's the president of Pipeline, the company that sponsors the show, and he's also the host of the show. He actually disassembled a treadmill and put it under his stand-up desk, so he walks while he has a lot of video calls, and he gets his exercise in, so he has a big family too.
Yeah, the walking desks. I think they started with exactly like that. Folks like Aaron made their own. And then now, if you're not able to do that, I think you can actually buy them. But yeah, walking while doing this stuff or spinning, anything to keep the blood flowing and the calories burning is good.
I'm still trying to visualize your bike setup. Like, do you have your laptop where your handlebars are? Is that how you have it set up?
Well, I built like this music stand out of old stuff, steel, and then plywood top. It's in an angle. And the plywood top in an angle is cantilevered out, so it's over top of the handlebars. So I'm usually, you know, down with one hand on the handlebars or just sitting up while I'm pedaling. And I got my laptop on there or paper I'm reading. And I can move it around a little bit.
And do you ever use the voice command to respond, or do you always type with your fingers?
I ended up trying that. I'm sure there's better software, and the software has evolved. It it works okay, but then I have to go back and make a lot of corrections. Although some people who see my emails and stuff would say, is that Alex typing with only a few what's left of his fingers, or is that the command?
Oh, for sure. When it comes to emails, a lot of time is done is better than perfect.
Right.
You want to respond in a timely manner and do the best you can. So let's see. So you have a lot of people, or you have people in your lab, and there are, I was wondering, what are three tips for managers who manage mechanical design engineers? The more specific, the better.
The first thing is to help them realize what we just talked about, that you can have a family and a life and do great at work and pass on the crayon and paper trick. Because if they're happier at home, they'll be happier at work and they'll be more productive. The next thing is I try to practice, using humor, a little bit of self-deprecation at times. If I can show them, the people who work with me, that I don't have an ego, then they damn well better not have one, dude. Right? So that's, you got to set the example. And then after that, a lot of peer review going around the circles. We have this thing we call PREP, or peer review evaluation process. Sometimes you have a team that is just wired through the ether of the air. So everything clicks. And other times you have team of all different kinds of mind processes, and it's hard to get all those squirrels lined up so your herd of cats can make them move. What I try to encourage them to do is, the way you can be heard, and that's so critical, people want to be heard, and the way you can hear, it's so critical to hear so you can find ideas, is we say, if you got a hard problem, let's just agree what the problem is. Okay, everybody in their design notebook or scraps of paper, whatever, go away and think by yourself and write your ideas down in accordance with the functional requirements of what you're supposed to be solving the problem of, right? You do that all alone, and then you come back as the team, and you just pass around the notebooks, and everybody reads what everyone else has done with no talking. You take the notebook back and read it by yourself, and feel free to comment on it, scribble like, I don't think that'll work. That's going to break. Well, and then you do a quickie calculation as to the moment of inertia and stresses, and is the thing going to break? And if you can fix or better the idea that's in front of you, you do so right in their notebook. Then you all come back together. Everybody reads what's been written in their notebook by everyone else. Now you have this collective mind of you have absorbed the thoughts of all people together. And then you brainstorm. Because if you don't do that, what you end up happening is you got a whole bunch of smart people in a room, and everyone has, I think. And everybody's so busy saying what they think because they want to be heard that they don't listen to the other people always. Now, you as a manager, me as a manager, I now have a written record of who was the original thinker of the thought. So when it does come time for promotions and patents and stuff, we really have it written down as to who's doing what. Because sometimes you got to cull the litter, right? And there you'll find in every organization, particularly as your organization gets bigger, there are people who talk a great story and they're always right there to explain what the team is doing. But those people didn't always have the idea. And now I can see if that's true and they're just a voice or not, because I can look at the notebooks. I hope that wasn't too long-winded.
No, that's amazing. I'm actually taking notes myself when you're saying this. So passing around the notebooks. So I guess when people join your lab, they are given a notebook, or you ask them to have their notebook, right?
Yeah, I ask them to have a notebook. I'm horrifically bad at this. I got paper all over my office here. I got 1, 2, 3 open notebooks, 4 or 5 notepads. So I do a lot of scribbling, and then I do a lot of scan and enter. My excuse is severe scatterbrainification, right? So I tell people, look, it's preferable if you have a notebook that you put everything in. If not, if you have scraps of paper, 3-ring binder or folder, but certainly in today's world, just with your phone, you scan it all in. right? So, but okay. I'm not really rigid on enforcing those specific personal habits of notebook with, you know, stickers on the side. And you know, engineers are too creative, and if you start doing that often, you'll stifle the creativity.
I've heard a saying that says something along the lines of never have a meeting that's so big that one pizza is too little for the room, basically. So how big are your meetings where people are passing around their notebooks? What's the max?
Oh, yeah, with a design team like that, you know, 3 to 5 at most.
Okay.
You can't do this with, you know, umpteen people. If you have a big design team on a big project, I think in general, almost every project I can think of, you know, it's like a water flow. There's a big complex design is chopped up into modules, and then modules may have submodules, and you'll get down eventually to 3 or 4-ish. And then the person responsible for the module, where there's a team of, you know, 3 to 5 people on that module, well, each module's team leader then gets together to do that process. So you see, it's like a bubble up.
I see. I feel like you have a sixth sense when it comes to almost telling what people are like. And I imagine that a lot of people want to apply and work at your lab, and you have to be somewhat selective in who can join and who can't. Unfortunately, they're not unlimited spots. So when you have maybe that interview session with the student that wants to join your lab, number one, how can you detect if there's like an ego? And number two, what's the speech like? So you prep them. So you put they put the ego at the door. Is that what you say? Just leave the ego at the door?
Yeah, I never tell anybody that right up front. I'll, you know, kind of give, here's the intro to my lab. We don't have egos that people can see because my office is a mess and I wear bright colors and my hair's in all directions. And it's always been that way. And you know, the chemistry is different. Some people must have a suit and tie, and they will only work for someone with a suit and tie, and God bless them. Everybody needs to find the chemistry that makes them feel happy. And there is such a wide variety of chemistries out there that everybody can find their place. So that's the first thing. So the second thing is, I just start talking with people and I want to hear what they do. And then I follow a thread and then I watch them. My office is full of stuff. It's a junkyard. And my table is just packed with junk stuff, bearings, all kinds of stuff I've collected over the years. And I watched how they play. If you're, and again, it depends on everything. Everything's different. Interviewing a software person is going to be different than a machine design. Everybody's different, but for now we'll focus on machine design. And I watch how they play. And then I ask them questions, you know, well, that's interesting. How strong do you think that could be? You know, and then I have a big whiteboard and I say, you know, well, explain to me how you think we can make this better. And I try not to do it as a challenge question, but as if we were having a real design session, you as an engineer brought to me your brilliant idea and we are working it out because we got to have production drawings ready in a week, dude. We got to make money. And prayer is a really fantastic thing potentially in your personal life. Does not belong in design. I was telling them when we start working, well, I think that's about right. Well, we got to optimize it. Well, I think based on my experience, and I usually say, well, all right, but just remember, if you have to say, dear God, please make this piece of shit work. I don't feel like I'll make it work. I don't have time. I want to drink beer with my buddies. So just make this shit work for me, please, dude. Yeah. God will like look at you and say, I gave you a brain, dude. You know, I got my own stuff to do. Universes to build, et cetera, et cetera. No, you go figure it out. Ooh, I said that word, super hyper interactive thinking. That's the acronym. And if you want to use the German acronym, SCHIT, it's super critical hyperactive interactive thinking.
Oh, for sure. This I wasn't prepared to ask you this question, but I have to ask you. It just spread out in my mind. Where do you get all your energy and enthusiasm from? It's really good.
I'm actually a space alien. I feed upon the mortal souls of the humans. If you think about it, when you're excited and someone else is excited that you're excited and they see you're generally groovy about it, they get excited. So then you get excited. And this is what being a human is about, is harnessing the energy of excitement. Good. Now, there's the whole yin yang where some people spread fear and hate. To them, I think they soon will meet their fate. The whole yin yang thing, right? So if you can get the positive energy flowing in the team, they are positive, you are positive, and you just have a better day. Now, sometimes, you know, you have to be the meanie. but we try to minimize the meaniness function required.
Sure thing. For my next question is somewhat of a long intro, so I'm going to talk for almost a minute. So I have to frame it correctly. So I like to ask people who have achieved success for advice in their areas of expertise. For instance, I would only ask a very fit person who has the body that I want for fitness and nutrition advice. So you've had plenty of triumphs launching and monetizing your own inventions, which I admire. Hence, you're absolutely perfect for this question. The majority of mechanical designers I know work for a company and develop what the client needs. I have a lot of respect for this. However, it seems somewhat unfortunate that once the contract or project ends, the mechanical designer doesn't gain any further profit from the design they've created. It's like cutting the umbilical cord when the project is delivered. It becomes the project becomes our baby. So the following five questions are for some of the mechanical designers who have an enterprising mindset like myself. And I want to clarify that sometimes ambition can be seen in a negative light, but if one has the right mindset, you're doing things for the right reasons, and you want to help people with your gift or talents, I don't think there's anything wrong with striving for financial success. So no, question number one is, as a mechanical designer, I know that I can earn money by doing A, working at a company, B, doing freelance work. Is there another way in which mechanical designers can make money? So please expand our horizons if there's maybe a third or fourth path that we're not aware of.
That's a really great question, by the way. There kind of is that it's so simple and in front of us that we often don't even see it. And as engineers, we're human. And all humans are looking for the fountain of youth. And if we have to remember, if something's too good to be true, it usually is. So the best thing you can do, other than the things you just mentioned, invest in the company in which you work. And if it's not publicly traded, they should have a way for every employee, like an employee stock option thing, to invest in your own company. That's the first one. And why is that so interesting? You'll find, you know, capitalism is a very good thing. And if you're working on something for your company that, man, this is a great product, this will motivate you to do even better, right? Because the better job you do, the more that will sell, the more the value of your company's stock. Now, that's not going to make you rich overnight. But remember, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32... you know, keep reinvesting at least a portion of the dividends or profits back into it. And if you now, as an engineer, go back 20 years and you can look at the stock market and you can see where it went up and went down, blah, blah, blah. But overall, if you stuck with it for the long term, investing in solid companies, they go up. Now, sometimes you're lucky and you buy, you know, a Tesla or Apple or something, and it really goes up. So that's the first thing. The second thing is return on investment in time. Let's go back to the how you can work at home, you know, do stuff at home and be happier at work and at home. So beware chasing money as opposed to chasing happiness is also very valuable. Okay. And that's the first part of the answer, unless you want me to dive deeper on something else.
Well, thank you for giving me a time to follow up on this, because I wonder, when one has an LLC, let's see, we all work at a company, it's an LLC, maybe we're at the 10, 15 employee mark, and the company doesn't yet offer to sell its stocks to its team members so they can buy some of the company stocks. My question would be, what's like a threshold that a company reaches for maturity-wise that it is time for the company to perhaps start offering its employees to buy some of its stock?
That's a good question. I don't think I have an answer, so I can guess now. I think it's never too early. Now, you got to remember, everyone has to remember that, you know, equity you guard with your life. Everybody wants to come in and say, well, you know, I'll give you advice and stuff. It's only 1%. And there's those folks out there who will roam about trying to get 1% of 100 different companies, knowing that only 10% of them will ever succeed. And yet once they get their percent, they disappear and they don't do anything. So this is where business folks or anybody who's been doing companies before successfully knows you guard equity with your life. But on the other hand, you're never going to grow your company to make it valuable unless your people are really motivated. So I think what you have to do is you have to say, here's a plan. Even when you say have above a few people it's vesting. And so the people who are going to stick with it will, and you can award some, and I don't think you can actually sell them stock. You can offer them the ability to invest in the company. You got to be careful and talk to your business and tax people there. But I'm a believer in you do this from early on.
Sure thing. Okay, so for, I guess, any founders who have a company who may be interested in selling some of the stock to their employees, I guess you need to, the next follow-up would be just talk to your business people or tax people. Is that right?
Yep.
So you wanted to maybe finish the second half of that answer. If you still have it, go ahead. I'm all ears.
Yeah, you know, the other thing is you got to also, as an engineer, so the first thing as an engineer, you got to do statistics and long-term trends and look at the data, as opposed to the human, oh boy, you know, I'm going to strike it rich, the fountain of youth, the gambler that's in us all. I think it's part of our gene. See what's on the other side of the hill. Maybe I'll get there first and have some more nuts and, you know, berries and things to eat, because this probably goes back a long way. But the next thing is to recognize that invention, I'm going to invent the next thing. Well, when you look at the data again, somewhere around 1 in 100 patents actually makes some reasonable money. Most of them are there, and it's not that the other 99 are worthless. Often it'll take a family of patents to be in support of what is actually the product that does come out. But in general, just having a patent or a brilliant idea doesn't get you anything. And here's the funny thing. You'll come up with an idea. Man, it's great. And your friends will look at it because you made a prototype. Oh, that's really cool, dude. You know, you should patent that. You should turn it into a product. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to do that, dude. All right. And then when it comes time to actually take orders where they have to turn over the money, times are pretty tough, man. You know, like, you know, yeah, I'm not really sure, you know. Yeah, I got this other thing I'm saving up for. So in other words, you got to be really careful of having a great idea, because people are your friends and they want to be supportive and they'll tell you it's a great idea and it may seem like an okay idea. But when it comes time to actually part with it, cash for it, that's when you find most of them evaporate, right? So you got to remember that if you have a great idea, build it, make a bunch, try it. Before you get too excited about actually going into production, make sure you have actual orders in hand, because most ideas, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen. I've got a whole flock of them that went nowhere, will go nowhere, but it was sure fun fantasizing about them.
Is there a particular trait about, you say you have plenty of ideas, but you also have ideas that have been successful. So is there a certain trait about the successful ideas that you're able to identify?
Well, okay, so I've had some really brilliant ideas. God, I'm so smart sometimes. Which, in other words, God, what an idiot. I can't believe I thought of that. I work mostly in machinery, where the stuff I do requires a fair amount of you know, specialized knowledge to create it. So it's a little unfair, because if you don't have the math, you can't compete. And so if you can't compete, that means I have less competition, which is easier. Unfortunately, less need of things for that. Now, there's a lot of consumer product type things, little gizmos, a lot more potential there that doesn't really need any complex math to do. But now you got a whole lot of people doing them, so you got a whole lot of competition. It's like everything averages out to zero, right? Okay, so here, for example, I had this fantastic idea long ago. I noticed, because I travel a lot, you know, they give you a bar of soap. And I finish with the soap, and then by law, they have to throw it away. They're not going to leave the soap for the next person. And you don't want to check into a hotel where there's a bar of soap there with some strange hairs stuck to it. Most people don't. So I thought, you know, but if you make the soap just the amount of soap you need, now it breaks. Oh, man, dude, I got an idea. And remember Pringles potato chips? So, you know, it's doubly curved. So you could make a structure that's very lightweight that's actually strong. And then if you make it certain way of shapey, it actually can massage and feel good. And so I carved up a bunch of bars of soap, and yeah, it works. So I went, and this would be my first consumer product, right? So we filed a patent. We got the patent issued. And I even called it massage soap. And a buddy of mine, Mark Graham, he was a student and a friend. We helped co-teach a lot and stuff. He has a rap group for fun. He does raps. And Mark wrote a rap for it called Massage Your Soap. When you want your body, when you want to feel as good as you smell, massage your soap. It was fantastic. We entered this dial soap competition. We won. We were steaming ahead. Boy, this would be great. And I can't tell you which company said, you know, here, 50 grand for your idea. Walk away from it. I should have sold, and I didn't. And then I guess 6 months later, you started seeing all these bars of soap with the little bumps on them. And what was to be a sure thing, and I was going to be lord of the soap world, just dissolved away. Great idea. I think it's still a great idea. I think my soap is still better than anybody else's soap. But in the end, no one's going to pay you for it because there's so many other ways of doing it. So that's what you have to be careful of, right? You may have the killer idea, maybe a great product, but in general, the mindset out there is no one wants to pay for anything. And I think the whole online culture of everything is free has exacerbated the difficulty with bringing a product to market. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't, but you got to be really, really careful about convincing yourself how brilliant your idea is. Now we're getting all the way back to the ego thing, right?
So I guess they went around your patent and provided a soap that's similar, right?
Well, no. Well, they didn't violate the patent. The patent, and this is part of what the patent system is for, by the way. They looked at it. They read the claims, I'm sure. They thought about the different functional requirements of what to be done, blah, blah, blah. And they found out a way to get good enough without violating the patent. So I did the function of the patent was a good catalyst for them, I think. Right? So in other words, if you have an idea and you haven't really invested that much money into it and you made a few little ones and it looks pretty good and some big gorilla on the block says, you know, we are the giant company. Here's 50 grand for your idea. Now go away, kid. Take it. Take the money and run. Whee!
So if you get to that point again where the big gorilla comes up to you, are you always going to sell it?
Pretty much.
Okay. At least we know how things work. Thank you.
Yep. Here's what happens. And I'm sure you've had this happen. Most creative people have had this happen. You see something and you say, that's a really cool idea. Oh, I can do better. It's part of you, the ego part of you, which is okay to have, is to look at something and say, oh, I can do better. That's a good part. That's an ego you're allowed to have. Just keep it to yourself, right? And then work on stuff. So the problem is that you have a great product, but now you're exposing it to all these really brilliant creative people who, if they have to pay any amount of money for it over what they normally are buying and doing, they'll want to come up with a better idea. And companies hire those people to say, here's an idea. Here's the patents on it. Figure out a better way for less.
I see. So you seem like someone that gets a lot of stuff done every day. Like if I were to give 24 hours to someone and I give 24 hours to you, at the end of the day, I have a feeling that you will come back with more than what other people will come back with. So what advice would you give someone that wants to get more stuff done every day? In addition to the things you already mentioned before, if there's anything else.
Learn how you think. And study how you operate and where your Occam's razor is, so to speak. By that, I mean, I know that if I work on something, I kind of keep a running barometer of progress. And when I get stuck and in other words, my productivity is going down, I leave it and I go do something else. Now, I'm rather ADHD plus, so that's really easy for me to do in general, but I also happen to be fairly CDO. CDO? What the hell is that? I think my brother first said this. No. It's what normal people call OCD, but who the hell put the O before the C and the D? That's not alphabetical order, so you got to move the O to the end, right? Being, you know, OCD, got to have everything just right, perfect, so you can't have things non-alphabetical. You're allowed to laugh. So I can focus and work on something intently, but then I keep a little timer in the back going, are you not making progress? Boop, put it down, go to the next thing. And it's like a time sharing in your computer. Your computer is doing a lot of different processes and there are priority interrupts for things. So you learn what your operating system is and what your interrupts are and how to make sure you're never spinning your wheels or banging your head against the wall so you can always be productive.
When you switch to the next topic or exercise that you're working on, let's say that someone is studying physics. When you reach that point where you start banging your head against the wall and you're not being so productive, do you switch to something that's completely different, like something has to do with coloring or email, or can you go to maybe a different section of the physics book? What would you recommend?
I let my passion drive me. I sometimes will work on the same flavor problem, but I will a different angle of it. Or I say, you know, I'm going to go work on the software part, or you know what, I'm going to take a walk with my doggies, or now I have grandchildren, if they're around or whatever, I'll leave my office and I'll say, all right, attack, and then and then just change it. So you just have to learn who you are and be honest with yourself.
Okay, that's a great answer.
Guide you, don't let anybody else tell you who you are. You have to tell you who you are.
I find that sometimes your brain is fried or fatigued from thinking so hard and you need time to recover. Many people mindlessly scroll through social media or watch TV when this mental state arrives. I was going to ask you, what do you do when your brain feels fatigued, but you know your inbox is full and you have a ton of work left to do, but I think you already gave me an answer. You just switch tasks. Is that right?
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, I need a scheduled period of brain sludge. So, you know, wife and I will watch some mind-deadening show. We try to do it while we eat so we can double task because we know we got to eat. And you know you need some brain-dead time, but you don't want to be brain-dead and then have to also take time to eat separate because that burns up more time in the day, so being more efficient. We all sometimes watch while eating TV, which I know is just really stupid. You're not supposed to do that, but that's okay. Because we have a lot of personal time together in the woods anyway. Okay. But I prefer sports. Go for a run, bike ride, hike through the woods, play with a dog. So if I'm going to be not mentally working, I generally find physical tasking. I love to cut and split wood with a maul, not one of those hydraulic things. I like the old manual way. Okay. So that's something completely different and reset the brain while giving you exercise.
This actually leads me to my next topic. You mentioned that we're all in search of the fountain of youth. We all want to look younger, get younger, feel better, not have injuries. I agree with that. And it's well documented. If you just search your name on the internet, that you run triathlons and you're quite the athlete. So any golden nuggets you may have in terms of your fitness to avoid injuries and maybe nutrition wise?
Yeah. Okay. So when I was a young person, I was really into powerlifting and bodybuilding and stuff. This was back in the days when you don't do aerobic stuff because that'll take away, you know, from muscle mass. Yeah. Now, of course, people know better. But anyway, so, you know, I was a big, strong fella, but then, you know, I had kids and I wasn't really exercising a lot. And I started to shift mass So I got quite a belly. And then, so in other words, I never was an aerobic person. And then when I was 40, you know, when you're 40, you have a life change. And my doctor, she took her veterinary glove off and said, sir, you're in a lot of world of hurt. And started writing out prescriptions for, you know, high blood pressure, high sugar, you know, blah, blah, blah. Lower this, lower that, lower the other. And I did a little research and I said, that's going to lower the other thing too. And she goes, oh, right. So she goes, I'll write your prescription for that too. You know, the little blue pill. And I'm like, this is a lot of drugs. And isn't there something else I could do? And she looked at me and she must be part psychiatrist. She says, you can exercise and lose weight, but no one ever really follows through with that. So you might as well just stick with the prescriptions. It's like, oh, I'm fighting words, right? So I went and researched it, and I found the reason people don't stick with it is, being a man, I know that I may be 40, but damn it, I'm still 16. I'm going to go out and exercise and run a marathon tomorrow and hurt myself. So that's what usually people do, is they dive into it too fast and too strong, and then they get injured and then they give up. So the key is like compound interest. So I said, okay, I'm going to start swimming because I was too heavy to run. You know, I was walking a little bit. And when I started at 40, I could go across the pool and almost back. So that'd be a total of what, 50 yards? And I was out of breath. But what the key is, for a week, you do what you can do comfortably, and the next week, you try to add 10%. So I would go in, I'd swim my 50 yards, I'd breathe for a few minutes, mix it, and then go back. And, you know, so I maybe would put in, I don't remember what that was, a quarter mile total. And then over a period of, I started losing some weight, and I was doing more walking, and then I started running a little bit. And then I still remember when I ran around where we live, it's a 3 mile loop. I started where I would run to the beaver pond, which was 3/4 mile, and walk back. I was very proud of myself. And there was a hill to the right that led to the 3 mile loop. Oh, I was so excited. It was like, oh, I'm going to lose my 3 mile virginity today, dude. I'm so excited. Did it? It hurt. It really did. But I did it. I lost my 3 mile virginity. I was so excited. Now I'm ready for a marathon. Yeah. And it took a while. And then I ran my first marathon down in Kiowa Island. And actually, I got in the marathons because a buddy of mine, Peter Mugglestone, the really brilliant bearing designer, he's really the parent of most of Thompson Industries, their profile rail bearings. You know, another guy, Greg Lyons, boy, they're smart. But anyway, Peter was also a marathoner who he would actually win in his age group. About 10 miles or 10 years older than I am. And we were working professionally and he was learning what I was doing. And he said, well, here, I'll help you out on training. And then he gave me a training program. Again, a little bit each week, add, dial back a little bit more. And so just compound interest. It took a year before I was ready to run my first marathon down in Kiowa Island. It was great. I think I was like 4 hours and 40 minutes or 30 minutes. And I couldn't walk for days afterwards. It was awesome. And then, you know, sometimes when you're a little older, your partner will like bring home something to spice up your life. And I was swimming and running and I was like riding a bike. Anyway, Debbie comes home one day. She says, hey, I bought you a magazine. And I said, really, what is it? She goes, yeah, look this out. And it was like Triathlon News or something like that. And like, really? And she goes, yeah, you did your marathon. You should try a triathlon, man, because you're doing the swimming and running stuff, man, and biking. And I'm looking through this magazine, right? And there's this thing called Iron Man. What the fuck is this? Ooh, I used a strong word. I said, what? Anyway, frequent, urgent, creative kicking, right? That's for my martial arts part, right? Iron Man, huh? Swim 2.4 miles? Yeah, I don't know, maybe. Bike 112? Yeah, I love biking. Run a marathon then in the end? Are you people crazy? And then Debbie says, well, you ran a marathon. You should try the Ironman anyway. And not because she said it, I had to do it, you know? So that took a couple of years. I did a half iron first, trained real hard, followed the rule of 10% a week, and I did it. Now, comment, I am not fast. I am just a diesel engine. I don't do this to compete. I do this to finish and to have fun so I won't get hurt, so I can keep doing it. That's the key, my friend.
Right on. Moderation and pace yourself. Totally understand. So this seems like a good place for a quick pause to share with our listeners that testfixturedesign.com is where you can find and learn more about how we help medical device engineering teams who need turnkey custom test fixtures or automated equipment to assemble, inspect, characterize, or perform verification or validation testing on their devices. We're speaking with Alexander Slocum. So the next question is, I'm a big fan of residual income. Is it possible for a mechanical design engineer to design something that creates residual income for them? The only thing that I can imagine is maybe creating a design for an invention and getting royalties. Would that be the only way?
No, that's not the only way. That's a good intro, so to speak, this idea of residual income. So there's a bunch of ways to do it. What it really means is you work hard at something and then you can step away from it and the money keeps coming in. So you can do it in the context of your own profession by you've designed some really great gizmo and your company is selling a lot of them and you bought stock in your company. You can design some really great gizmo, build it up by making, testing, selling a few here and there, and then launch your own company in sales. But that's not so residual because you'll work real hard at it for a while before you can sell it out. Or you can design something, get it going, and then sell it to someone else. But that's really, really hard. Very few companies will buy an idea from somebody and then pay you a tag, you know, a royalty. That's really hard to do licensing. Because quite often the company will just say, why should I continue to pay this person or pay them in the first place? I'll just design around their patent. So that's what you have to be very careful of. Because that does happen a lot. So let's stick with, you've started a company and it's, you're selling product and then someone buys your company and they may or may not have a tail, but I would call that a residual. The other way is you take your money you earn and you invest it, not necessarily in the stock market, but for example, there's this really nice house or apartment or something, and then real estate, you know, because people always have to have a place to live. So you can follow the, in other words, invest in products and stuff that you're familiar and good at inventing. You can invest in the stock market in general, or you can go into real estate like you buy an apartment, then you rent it out. Those are good ways.
I see. When we spoke before, I asked you something, and you mentioned that tinkering was something that's very important for mechanical engineering to do in their downtime. And I was going to ask you, what are examples of good and useful tinkering versus perhaps not so useful tinkering? And I have to ask this because many listeners have never tinkered before, and we want to give them a clue as to whether they're doing the right path with their tinkering.
Okay, so I'm going to tie this into the residual income thing too. Tinkering is you're exploring things that are of interest to you. You're taking apart something, you know, and all of us have stuff that breaks, and you should always be thinking, particularly if it's in your line of what your work is, how does that work? Even a toaster, you know, how does that mechanism work? Take it apart, look at it. And so there's the function of tinkering to learn. And if you have kids, it's always good to take stuff apart with them and discuss each part and stuff. Okay. So that's a form of tinkering that's really good. The other form of tinkering is just fixing stuff around the house when it breaks instead of throwing it out, which we used to do a lot. And unfortunately, a lot of stuff you can't do anything with. You have a lawnmower and it dies. Yeah, you really, you know, because like it blows a seal and now it's leaking oil everywhere. You can sure go ahead and try to fix that level of it. I used to do things like that. Now I won't. But what I will do is I'll take the wheels off the lawnmower and I'll make a cart. So I have a little garden cart. Right. And then there's the tinkering mode. So that's kind of where we're building up. Of everyone has something that it annoys them or something they wish they had. So you make stuff for your own enjoyment. A new hat rack, write a piece of software to do something you want to have happen. you know, make your lights outside. If you put up Christmas lights, automatically go on, anything like that. And those kind of things you start to think of is potentially, if you like it and you make a solution for it, someone else may like it. This gets back to not having an ego. If you're just like everyone else, the good thing is that when you solve a problem, assuming you got there first, everyone else will like your solution and maybe you have a new product. So there's tinkering for the your own enjoyment and happiness enhancement and potentially a new product or thingy that everyone else is going to want that you could turn into a product or a company.
Amazing. That's a really good answer. And I found myself doing the right kind of tinkering then. I've done all the ones that you mentioned before. All right. The next question is, what technical skill set would I need if I want to generate income from my designs? And the more specific, the better.
Okay, well, you know, it's going to depend upon what flavor designing you're doing. There's a whole range of things, but let's take it from the mode of the massage soap example, right? You need to understand ergonomics more than anything else, the feel of things, what people like. So that's the first level, and that's the hardest thing to get, is this whole emotional the empathy ability. The next thing is, and the thing like a massage soap, you also have to understand mechanics. Now, there's two types of understanding of physics. And remember, physics starts with the letters PH, which is also the starting of the word philosophy. So when you look, remember how I described Pringles potato chips are curved. So the philosophy of the mechanics is a curved structure is stronger than a flat structure. So that enables me, with just thinking about the philosophy of the physics, to create a design without having to know any detailed mathematics. So I would say the first level is looking at what you're designing, working, is come to understand what physics is involved in it and what is the philosophy of that physics. And in this textbook I wrote called Fundamentals, it's spelled fundamental, but I say the fundamentals of design, people go to sleep. But if I say it's fundamental, fun, yes, be a little mental, maybe a lot of mental. You look for the deep inner meaning of things in the philosophy. And in that textbook, which is free online, topic 3, fundamentals of mechanical design. You know, I go through things like Occam's razor, Saint Vinet's principle, Maxwell's reciprocity. I discuss the philosophy of what these things mean. And then, okay, here is the math that goes with them. If you don't understand the philosophy, you have no hope of applying the math. And often the philosophy is all you need. Like Saint Vinet's principle, you have a shaft supported by bearings. How far apart should the bearings be? They should be 3 to 5 shaft diameters apart, such that the bearings will have real good moment control of the shaft. I didn't even have to do any math. I automatically know where to put my bearings. I can do the math and show, ooh, geez, that is the optimal spacing.
That's a great resource. I wanted to encourage all the listeners to go check out the fundamentals that he's referring about. Once you see the way that he capitalizes the fun in fundamentals, you'll never be able to read the word fundamentals normally again. It's got to be in your brain from there moving forward. So let's say that I have a novel idea for a product. I research it, and surprisingly, no one has done this before. I prototype it in my garage. It works. It solves a problem. I test the product with 20 niche customers, and they all say that they would be willing to buy it. In fact, they didn't just say that. They actually paid me ahead of time prior to production because they love the product so much and can't wait to get their hands on it. So I collected all this money, and now I need to build 20 of them. So I still have one prototype, and what do I do next? Where do I take this prototype? And my constraints are that I don't have $10,000 to $15,000 to pay for the injection molding, and I don't have the resources to run a Kickstarter campaign.
Okay, you know, the answer 10 years ago was probably a lot different than now. Now, the first thing is, you know, if a 3D print will be good enough for the strength, then you 3D print them. And you buy a 3D printer and you just have it go yeet, 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 and you just, you know, go to town. Right? Otherwise, as a craftsperson, you manually make each one, even if you have to carve it. And you do that instead of watching TV, you know, and you get some friends together and you do it the old fashioned way. You know, people used to make flintlocks by hand. And you do it so you deliver those 20 people have bought them and they say, this is great. And now you start getting more orders. Then you can either do a Kickstarter campaign or you go to the bank and you say, look, here's the sales I have, and you borrow money. Now, it's very important to make sure that you do a really careful patent search. And the way you do this is you got to go, not just do a patent search, but you got to go online and search. And like, we'll pick Google, but there's a lot of different search engines. And you search, and then you display images, and you search, and you look at all the images on all N pages. Make sure it doesn't already exist. Then you can also go do a patent search. And now if all that yields, yeah, you really do have something, then you got to be really careful. All these patent agencies that love to, you know, take 10 grand of your money and keep you on the string. You can prepare what is called a provisional application. Now, it's really easy. And I think on my class website, we even give you a template to do that. But a provisional application is basically you draw it up as good as you can, you know, your production drawings, and then you're going to describe exactly what it is you have and what problem it solves. And if you're not a serial inventor already, I think it's like $60 or something to file. The USPTO.gov, we pay taxes. It's a fantastic resource. It's our government on their website. It has a lot of free information about this, and it's really easy to file your own provisional. You do not need a lawyer at all. Now, that's like a placeholder. You now have 1 year to file the utility application, which is the, quote, real patent. But it gives you a year of protection. Now, you can't sue anybody until you have an issued patent, and you may get ripped off by someone here or there, but no big company is going to start making and selling something knowing that there's a patent lurking, because if they do, and then you do get a patent issued, well, you can't sue them for anything before your patent issues. But if they already put all this money in developing a product, they're not going to want to get sued for continuing forward. So that's the strategy there. Now, remember, just because you have a patent doesn't mean you can build it. That's not a license for you to build. It's a license for you to exclude other people from building, because you may actually infringe on someone else's patent. This is why you got to do the search. And the other thing is don't get too happy about thinking, well, they're all going to sue somebody. Like the minimum cost to go to court, blah, 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 and actually follow through in a lawsuit is around $1 million. Your chances of winning are at best 50-50. This is statistics. And even if you win, if it's a big company, they were going to appeal the decision, where your chances of winning on the appeal are maybe 50%. So the odds are 4-1 against you that you would ever prevail in a lawsuit. So think of a patent this way. It's an ability to exclude, and it's a license as you're driving down the road at high speed with a lot of people chasing after you to throw nails and glass and oil and you know, live chickens and all kinds of stuff out the back of your pickup to get in their way so you can zoom ahead to the next one.
That's a very visual description, yeah.
Don't forget the chickens.
Yeah. Okay, so provisional patents, we may want to look into that if you want to develop your own ideas. You said that you want to seek to handmake from common materials and sell those and build up orders until you're then willing to risk investing in the mold. So when you say this, I think about very rough prototypes, like you said, carving while you're watching TV, that maybe are not the most aesthetically pleasing, but they're functional. So do you know of companies that have followed this model that you just proposed successfully in selling the first batch of materials, kind of handmade? Ask so perhaps we can have we can research those companies and see what they did.
I'm not a real good consumer product person. I do know that when I say handmade, it also includes people who put together machines, like early 3D printers. If you go to, and they were bought, but it's called Other Mill. Other Mill was an idea for a small tabletop milling machine. It came out of a what's called Other Lab in San Francisco. A good friend of mine, Dr. Saul Griffith, runs that place. And he has a nice machine shop there. Nothing real fancy, you know, a water jet cutter, a router, you know, basic manual machine tools and stuff. I think they've got maybe a laser cutter. In other words, he has available to him for use all the time what a lot of the hobby places that exist, you know, where anybody can join and then make stuff in, right? So Saul always had this fantasy, which I guess a lot of people have, for a desktop mill, particularly for like milling circuit boards, because he does a lot of electronics prototyping and stuff. And a lot of people do. And now you can send out for a board pretty cheap. But when he started, it's a little more expensive, but you can buy the raw circuit board material and then mill out what you want, right? And leave the traces. And then also other simple features. So anyway, Saul and his buddies there, they decided to do this little mini mill, you know, tabletop. I've always loved that idea. I made one of my own in the past. And they started tinkering. And next step, it was people saw it, wanted, so they made more copies. But, you know, again, all manually put together. More copies, and they decided, wow, you know, this could be a business. And that launched Other Mill, which later was bought by, I don't remember who it was bought by, but you can search Other Mill, right? So there's an example of a good one.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
All right. I'm almost embarrassed to ask this question because it may seem a little naive, but I'm sure somebody else also has this question if I have it. So although I'm going to risk looking stupid in front of a lot of people, that's fine. I'm going to ask it anyways. So the question is, when there are there are physics that you don't understand in a product, could you talk to us a little bit about your process of trying to learn those physics? The more specific, the better.
No, that's not an embarrassing question. That's a great question. I often have that myself a lot, right? And I may have known it when I was younger, but now I forgot it, so I got to go back and relearn it. So what I try to do is just take a deep breath and say everything has a loop. Yeah, if you have a circuit, right, you have to have power and ground, and there's a bunch of details in between. If you have a machine, you have what's called the structural loop, where you're pushing on the machine at one point, say with a tool, but it pushes against, this is action reaction, the part, and there's a flow of forces between the tool and the part at the contact where you're cutting, but also back through the machine. Heat transfer, fluids, anything you look at, everything basically has a loop or loops. And that's what you're looking for, is to say, okay, what is the loop and what's going on in that loop? And just you carefully, slowly dissect what's going on. Now, if you're not really skilled in the details of that, you may miss something, like not realize that radiation is the dominant heat transfer mode here, not convection. Right? I mean, you're ignorant because you've never seen it. So you miss something in the loop that actually is driving the behavior of the system. So this is where peer review comes in. I'm never shy about first looking carefully at it myself, and then I search online for what looks similar in terms of the loop or things and try to learn online myself first. And then I'll ask friends for peer review of it. Right. And based on that peer review, sometimes, you know, dude, you got to take the impact loads in fact. And here's how, you know, and then boom, we go down that path. Or, hey, you know, warning, you know, you're going to have a galvanic corrosion going on here between these two materials. So that's where peer review comes in. And then once you get the key word from somebody, you know how to burrow and dig.
Sure thing. So we've all had, as mechanical design engineers or engineers, we've had people approach us, inventors, with ideas that they want to change the world with their idea. They have it in a napkin and they want to have 99% and maybe they'll give you 1% or something like that, because in their mind, the idea is the most important thing, but really it's all about execution. We all know this, listening to the podcast. And I know you're not a lawyer, but you're very smart and you've done this before. So by all the listeners, this is not legal advice by all means, but if you decide that you want to move forward maybe with an inventor and you do a 50-50 partnership with them, what would be the name of the document that you would have to sign next after the verbal agreement is reached?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to have a simple non-disclosure agreement where both sides agree not to start blabbing what you're doing to someone else. Okay. Right. And then, so that's the first thing you want to have there to protect everybody. The second thing is you do a letter of intent, plain English. Here is what we want to do and how we are going to do it. Now, you can go online, and that's the letter of intent, just to everybody agrees what's going to happen, we think. The next thing is an actual contract between two people for how they want to move forward. But the letter of intent serves most of that purpose. After that, you've got to really incorporate as a legal entity to move forward. And then now there's a host of books on letters of incorporation, is an LLC, et cetera, et cetera. And most of that's free online. You don't need a lawyer to start it out. You do want to have a business lawyer in the end, make sure for your particular state that all the proper documents are done. But this is not a, you know, $10,000 thing. This is a pretty straightforward exercise. And again, you can read about it online very nicely. Most states have a Better Business Bureau or a Small Business Administration they will help you for what you need to do.
Perfect. All right, Alex, if there's anything else that perhaps you want to add to your listeners, direct them towards a resource, any last thoughts? And finally, how can people reach you?
I just want people to be nice to each other. Remember that being nice is the most important thing you can do. Don't spread rumors and falsehoods and stay away from hate and fear. If for no other reason, it takes time away from you having as much fun as you can and being as productive as you can, right? So it's just stupid to be consumed by that stuff because you're not living then. And that's really actually quite serious advice, because you can spend so much time in social media following these threads where, remember, social media will feed you things that you're most responsive to. And the two things that humans are most responsive to are fear and hate. This is the survival instinct, and pornography. This is the reproductive instinct. And I'm serious in both of those. Very few of people follow threads of happy, good things other than vacation spots, right? So just stay away from most of this garbage on social media, other than just your immediate friend. Focus on goodness and having fun and being nice. Watch Miracle on 34th Street until it sinks in. Right, you know, which is all about being nice. It's totally non-religious. Let's see. I tweet a bunch of poems where I try to get people to think about it. It's at A.H. Slocum, if anybody's interested in my silly little poems. And I have a website, oseh.com. It's pronounced USA. And that means 1/sadness = happiness. Where, again, I post little poems and thingies. You can see a couple of the products that I did. They have not sold well. A lot of people have said they love them, and then they've gone off and made their own, knocked me off. I have patents. You know what? That's okay. If they're making it and being happy, I'm very happy for them.
I see you have a ventilator project on that website.
Yeah, we did. This is through my MIT work for an emergency ventilator. A lot of people working on that. We helped some folks actually bring theirs to market. I'm so happy none of them had to have been used, that the medical profession found out how to treat COVID you know, the various things they do. Because if you go in a ventilator, anybody's ventilator, your chances of coming off are very poor and your long-term damage is really high. It's not that ventilators themselves are bad, but the process of ventilation is not something that people were designed for. Yeah, so that's about it. And to get in touch with me, you know, you can try emailing me, just slocum@mit.edu. I try to answer as many as I can, like when I'm spinning. And if I don't, please don't get mad. You know, lots of squirrels to chase in this world.
I'm Aaron Moncur, founder of Pipeline Design and Engineering. If you liked what you heard today, please leave us a positive review. It really helps other people find the show. To learn how your engineering team can leverage our team's expertise in developing turnkey custom test fixtures, automated equipment, and product design, visit us at testfixturedesign.com. Thanks for listening.